This morning's shiur is entitled Family Systems and Reishit Models of Marriage. My background, both before and while I was beginning my teaching career, is in psychology. I have a bachelor's in psychology, a master's in psychology, and half a doctorate, which one of these days will get finished, in educational psychology. So almost from the get-go, I was interested in the psychological underpinnings of what was going on in Chumash, and particularly Sefer Bereishit, which is such a human sefer. So the first source, which comes from Pirkei Avot, which to me is like bar none my favorite text of all Jewish texts, possibly even more than Sefer Bereishit, really gives you my philosophy of learning and of teaching when it comes to Tanakh. Ben bag bag haya omer hafoch ba hafoch ba dechol haba, that really everything is in the Chumash, and it gives me a particular thrill when theories or discoveries, whether they're scientific, historical, psychological, sociological, whatever they are, they come out and I can just smile and like, okay, like the Prager commercial, it's in there. So I would like to propose using Sefer Bereishit as a model for family systems theory, and just in brief, family systems theory is something that came out of the world of psychology beginning about in the late 1960s, early 1970s, which viewed families and people within families as a system, rather than psychoanalytic theory, which really, I told you I hate these things, which really views each individual in a vacuum and sees kind of one individual and that individual's relationships really as a vector really going only in one direction. Family systems theory sees families, not to be obvious, as systems. And basically, it's in some ways a much more female view of a family, in that no one person exists by him or herself. And anything that one person does affects everybody else in the family, and in turn, that person is affected by everybody else in the family, and those people are affected by those people. And it's a very intricate kind of system. The amazing thing about family systems is that while everybody is connected to everybody else, the behavior of one person impacts everybody else. Obviously, that applies to everybody. So what I want to look at is how the Chumash, particularly Sefer Bereishit, looks at the models of marriage in the sense of how husband and wife interact and how the behavior of one affects the other. You can also look at the interaction between parents and children, between siblings, even between children-in-law and parents-in-law. But for today, I want to focus on marriage. The first model that we have of marriage is in the creation of male and female. And here I borrow very, very heavily from Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal and his seminal work, Lonely Man of Faith, where he writes that the fundamental difference between Adam 1 and Adam 2, the account of Bereishit in Perek Aleph and the account of Bereishit in Perek Bet, is that in Perek Aleph, male and female, and you don't have the source here, male and female were created at the same moment. Zachar u'nekeva bara otam. That on a biological level, on the level at which the world was created, physiologically, biologically, genetically, chemically, all of that material type of creation, male and female are equal. They are the same, they are one. So it was very mysterious why in Perek Bet, the Sefer Bereishit, there's this account of how Adam HaRishon is alone. And the Rav takes from the famous Zohar, which writes that when male and female were created, they were created kiviyachol as Siamese twins, back to back. And the rib that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took out of Adam HaRishon was not as we usually think of as a rib in the front, but basically as a rib in the back. And the way the Rub conceptualized this is that you had two human beings who were equal, who were functionally the same, but who were not able to relate to each other. And what the Rav writes is that the world that was created in Bereishit Perek Aleph was a world of science, was a world of objectivity, was a world of nature. This is why the word Elohim is used exclusively in Perek Aleph. This is why the verb bara, to create, which really, according to the Ramban, means something from nothing. The world that was created in Aleph was the world of science, the world of mathematics, the world of physics, of neutrons, of, you know, CERN, you know, smashing things, which apparently now is going back online, so your $16 billion that they've used to build it is actually worth something. It's the world of a computer, basically. And we know that computers can be programmed to do basically anything except feel and except relate. So in Perek Bet, we find Adam, we find what I call a humanoid rather than male, as being alone. And the Torah says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Lo tov hayot ha'adam levado. And the word tov is famously mistranslated as meaning good. The word tov actually doesn't mean good, because good is a relative term. And, you know, if you're sick and tired of everybody bothering you, it might be a really good thing for you to spend a significant amount of time by yourself. You might like it. You might cherish it. You might pay a lot of money to go off and do it. Tov, and here I use the opinion of the Rashbam in Sefer Shmot, actually means perfect or complete. In other words, if you think about how the word tov is used in Maaseh Bereishit, right, Vayar Elohim ki tov, and Elohim saw that it was tov. Well, if tov means good in Perek Aleph, there's an implication that there's something bad. If there's something bad, that means there's something missing, which means that the world that God created was not perfect. Whereas if you use the word tov to mean complete or functional or doing its job, all of a sudden, a cancer gene can be tov, because even though the work of that cancer gene is destructive, it's doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu programmed it to do. An atom bomb is most definitely not tov, but the hydrogen atoms and the explosion is doing what Elohim, what the forces of nature put in the world to do. So when Hashem said in Perek Bet, Lo tov hayot ha'adam levado, and by the way, it's not just Elohim who's talking in Perek Bet, it's Hashem Elohim. And we know that Hashem is the Midah of Rachamim, and Hashem, that name Yud with the Hey, with the Vav followed with the Hey, which by the way is marked in Nikeva, in female, which is a shir unto itself, is also the name of the miraculous, of that beyond science and beyond the objective. Humans are not complete when they are not in relationships, writes Rav Soloveitchik. So what Hashem did in the second parak was he took these two humanoids, which were either facing back to back, or you can imagine them like two-year-olds who are sitting in the same little room and they're playing, and it looks like they're playing together, whereas really developmentally what they're doing is called parallel play. They're not interacting. So you can see Adam and Chava as they were created as two individuals, two computers basically, processing, doing what they were supposed to do, but not facing each other. And that's where we also get the concept of the Ezer Kenegdo, that the ideal relationship as it's conceived of in the moment of creation is one male, one female, facing each other in a communicative relationship. And that each member of that relationship might be complete without the other, because they were created as complete humans, but they're not functioning at optimal capacity. because they're not relating to one another. And it's in Bereshit when Hashem separates them and allows them to face each other, and by the beginning of Perek Gimel, places them in Gan Eden, actually already in Perek Bet, La'ovda L'shomra, to work it and to take care of it, to guard it, to be in a relationship with not only with one another, but with a common goal, with a common task. That's when at the end of Perek Bet, it says, Al ken yazov ish et aviv ve'et imo v'davach v'ishto v'hayu l'basar echad, that the goal of a union, the goal of a marriage fundamentally is to create a new unit, for that man to leave his parents' household, and obviously for the woman to leave her parents' household, to come together on a physical level, that's Bereshit Aleph, and on a spiritual level, that's Bereshit Bet, and we know that Dvekut is both physical and spiritual union, and it's the kind of union that we are asked to have with God, and the Hayu L'Basar Echad, that they should be one unit, one flesh. So that's the ideal of a union. That's the ideal model of marriage, is two human beings in communication, facing each other, working together towards a common goal. What I believe the Avot and the Imahot demonstrate to us in later Prakim is how those unions work. Because we know that there's more than one way to relate to another human being. There's more than one way to get a job done. There's more than one personality. Physiological psychology, for example, describes human beings as having three basic temperaments. And a temperament, as opposed to personality, is something that's part of your genetics. Like, for example, some people are more sensitive to noise and light. Some people are less so. Some people, we call them type A personalities, love challenges. Other people run away from them. Some people love to bungee jump, and as far as I'm concerned, I'd rather put a gun to my head than jump off a bridge with some kind of rope attached to me. Some people like to talk, and some people like to be quiet. These are things that are actually hardwired in us. So the three basic temperaments in this theory is what's called an easy temperament, a difficult temperament, and a slow to warm up temperament. These are not good or bad. These are not value judgments. The easy temperament is kind of that laid back, calm, chill human being who on the one hand is very easy to get along with, on the other hand might not get the job done on time. In other words, you might want the easy personality to go spazier in the mall, but you don't want the easy personality if you've got a project that has to be done at 8 o'clock Monday morning, because that personality will be like, all right, whatever, if it's 9 o'clock, if it's Tuesday, it's no big deal. The difficult personality is that, like, really persnickety one, you know, the one who will take every sheet out of her linen closet before Pesach, even though she knows that dirt is not chametz, because this is the way it has to be. It's that, like, yekish, I'm a yek, blue-blooded here. You know, born and bred, 7 o'clock is 7 o'clock, is not 6:59, is not 7:01. Which, on the one hand, is annoying as all get-out. But on the other hand, if you've got a neurosurgeon with that kind of personality, you're going to get the best neurosurgery you can, because the attention that that surgeon will pay to detail is extraordinary. And then there's the slow to warm up personality, which is exactly what it sounds like, which is those people that when you first meet them seem kind of snobby or aloof or reserved or shy, and really they're not any of those. They're just quiet. And it's that still waters run deep personality who, the more you get to know that person, the more that person will open up and the more that person will warm up. Well, if you have a difficult person, a person who's married to a slow to warm up person, that might be a problem. If you've got an easy person who's married to a difficult person, that might be a problem. If you've got a slow to warm up person with an easy person, that might be a problem. On the other hand, all of those problems can be worked out. So the point of this little mini psychology lesson here is to say that Abraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, and Yaakov and his wives, Rachel and Leah, each presented to us a different model of marriage. No model of marriage is better than any other model of marriage. Each model of marriage has its strengths and its weaknesses, its successes and its failures. So we're going to go to Abraham and Sarah first. We meet Abraham and Sarah at actually the end of Parshat Noach, but what the source, I believe we're up to source, I don't know, 5, something like that. I don't see too well. Breishit, yeah, it's source, actually, no, that's Bet. I don't know, somebody yell it out. You'd Bet, source 5. Ha, I was right, how about that? Okay, so we meet Abraham and Sarah, actually already at the end of Parshat Noach, but here it's the beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha, and they have now arrived at Canaan. Now, it's important to note that when we meet Abraham and Sarah, they are the only couple that we meet together, and that we meet both of them at the same time, and both of them by name. Even Adam and Chava. In other words, Adam and Chava, we meet Adam by name, although Chava has already been created. We only get her name later. Noah, we know he has a wife, but we don't know what she's called. And Yitzhak and Yaakov, we obviously meet them first, and we meet their wives separate. It's important to note, I think, that Avraham and Sarah, or Avram and Sarai, as they're referred to at the end of Parshat Noach, we meet at the same time because fundamentally this is a marriage of equals. And I think the best explication of this equality is in the famous Rashi, Avraham Megayeret Anashim, and I think this is source 6, and Sarah Megayeret Et Anashim. The relationship between Abraham and Sarah was basically a partnership, and a partnership of equals. They grew up together in the same town. It's the only couple that of the three that grow up together. They leave together. It's written in plural. When they leave, there's no indication that Abraham had to drag Sarah. She didn't have to go anywhere. No one had to leave home to marry the other, as in Yitzhak and Rivka, and Yaakov and Rachel. And they come to the same place and the same path together. And they work together. And we see this time after time after time. I believe that the statement at the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, which I don't think you have here, of, you know, Hine na yadati ki yifat toar at, that, you know, this very weird statement that Avraham notices that Sarah is beautiful. I mean, they've been together for quite a long time. Avraham is 75, she's 66. Quick math, right? What does it mean, I'm noticing that you're beautiful? Because when you are in a working relationship with somebody, what they look like really isn't relevant. It's how you work together. I mean, this is kind of the basis of all of this concept of sexual harassment in the workplace, if you think about it. In other words, you've got a man and a woman who are working together in the same place of business. What she's wearing, or how tall she is, or how thin she is, or for that matter, you know, how tight his abs might be, should have absolutely no relevance to the job that you're going to do. And when it does start having relevance, it can pose a problem. And that's exactly what Avraham notices, is when Sarah's appearance is a potential problem to them being able to accomplish the job of leaving Canaan, going to Mitzrayim, escaping the famine, and making sure they don't all die of hunger. Oh, wait. It's not a statement as to aesthetics. It's a statement of, there's a task in front of us. Your looks are an obstacle to that task. What are we going to do about it? And he proposes a very unethical and problematic solution to the problem, and she doesn't say anything. And we all take Sarah's silence as agreement. Sarah is not known for her silence. That's another thing. When you're in an equal partnership, when you're in a business relationship, you both talk, you both communicate. This is one of the time, this is like the only time that if you start thinking about it, that Sarah doesn't say anything. To me, that's very, very telling. I don't think Sarah was so cool with this plan. She did it. She followed through with what her husband suggested, but she didn't like it. If you look at you know, the next source, when it comes to the plan of having children, Sarah's very vocal. And Sarah says, I'm barren. Take my shifcha, and have a child. When that child becomes a threat to her child, she opens her mouth again. When God comes, when the Malachim come at the beginning of Vayera and tell them that they're going to have a child, very famously, we hear Sarah's laughter. Sarah is not silent. She's the least silent of all of the Imahot. She exemplifies that really very male model of business, which is do it, get the job done, don't mince words, don't hide your opinion, don't be a shrinking violet. It's a very masculine model. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu supports that model. He never the only time HaKadosh Baruch Hu chastises Sarah is when she laughs, and not because it's an insult to Avraham, but because it's an insult to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Adzerabba, when she says to Avraham, get rid of Yishmael, very famously Hashem says, Shma Bekola, which is another aspect of this model of marriage. If you've got two people who are in an equal partnership, Migayer Anashim, Migayeret et Hanashim, both people have an equal voice. And when that balance begins to tip into the more stereotypical gender role, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself says, uh-uh, this is the relationship that you have. You need to listen to what she has to say. Even if she is incredibly no ga'at badabar, when she's right, she's right. Yishmael is a threat. You have to get rid of him. So this is the Avraham and Sarah model. It's a model of partners. It's a model of equals. It's a model of a common goal, a common task, a mutuality, and a mutuality that sustains itself despite conflict. In other words, conflict, which in the American or the Western view of marriage, conflict is viewed as something negative. This is kind of a side point. If you look in Bereishit, conflict just is. And it's not necessarily viewed as something negative or something destructive. It just is, and it's something to be contended with. When Sarah laughs, Kadosh Baruch Hu says to Abraham, why is she laughing? You deal with it. When Sarah says, kick Yishmael out, and Abraham protests, they deal with it. When Avraham takes Yitzchak to the Akedah is where we no longer hear Sarah. That's according to the Midrash, that famous Midrash of the Satan showing Yitzchak to Sarah. I believe that's the conflict that was unresolvable, and we know that that was the conflict that literally caused her or led to or immediately preceded her death. It was the conflict that was irresolvable. It was a mission that Sarah, I believe, couldn't support and couldn't agree to, as opposed to the Mitzrayim mission, and it killed her. And we never see Sarah again. She dies, and we never, you know, Abraham is pretty much done too, and we move into Yitzchak. The model of marriage that Yitzchak and Rivka present to us is very, very different. First of all, they start off in different places, geographically. One is born in Canaan. We know that Yitzchak of the three Avot is the one who came from Canaan, who never left the boundaries of Canaan. So we know that on a geographic level, he's coming from one geographic location, and Rivka is coming from a geographically very different location. Yitzchak is coming from a place that's somewhat open to trade routes and the outside world, but fundamentally still, quote-unquote, more backward and more, you know, kind of like somebody who lives in the exurbs of Omaha, Nebraska, as opposed to Rivka, who grows up in, you know, something like Chicago or Indianapolis or Philadelphia. Maybe not Haran wasn't the quote-unquote the metropolis that where Kasdim was, but it was still a major trading center. It was still, you know, it was the beginning of the Tigris and the Euphrates. It wasn't that far from the Mediterranean, and it's a fairly cosmopolitan location. Geographically, it's very different. One place is hot, one place is more temperate, one place gets no rain or very little rain, the other place gets rain and snow. I mean, if you think about the different topography and geography and geology even of, you know, the Syrian, Lebanese-Syrian coast versus Hebron, you know, it's like somebody growing up in Arizona meeting somebody who grew up in Boston. So you've got two individuals from two geographically very different places. You also have two individuals coming from very, very different families and very different family values. You've got Yitzhak, who grows up in the house of Abraham, who is, you know, a charismatic, dynamic, outgoing Baal Chesed, versus Rivka, who grows up in the house of Betuel and Laban. We don't know much about Betuel. I really prefer to stick to the text. But we do know a lot about Laban, and what we know about Laban is not very complimentary. What we do see from the Midrash, and the Midrash paints the house of Betuel very, very negatively, it was a very miserly, very upwardly mobile, money is the be-all and end-all of everything kind of household. And one that was more, kind of the opposite of Abraham in the sense that it was very suspicious of strangers. You want to take the Midrash literally, that they tried to poison Eliezer or not. Clearly this was a culture, we know that all of the ancient Mesopotamian cultures were notoriously xenophobic and didn't like outsiders and didn't like strangers and didn't treat them very well, which is why Abraham is such a contradistinction to them. So they're coming from different cultures. They're coming from different places. Their ages are vastly different. Even if you don't accept the Midrash literally that Rivka was 3, there is clearly a difference between their developmental stage, their maturity. There's a big difference. And then we have their very first meeting, which I believe is source 11. I might be wrong. 9, maybe. The famous, no, 9 is still the, there's 9, 10, 13, 14. Vayhi Yitzchak, right, okay. The famous camel scene. I always wonder how that would be scripted or filmed as a movie, right? The famous Rivka falling off of her camel. Yitzchak must have been one really good looking dude. I have a very close friend of mine who wrote a whole essay on this scene, but this scene basically encapsulates the kind of relationship that Yitzchak and Rivka had. That Rivka, on an emotional level, on a spiritual level, realizes that Yitzchak is something very different. She definitely is not above him. She's not even equal to him. She realizes that on a spiritual level, she is literally at his feet. Remember, she meets him when he is out lasuach basadeh. He is out conversing in the fields. The Gemara describes this as he's being metakein mincha. But even without that, he is somebody who communes with the universe. Yitzchak is a philosopher. Yitzchak is a thinker. Yitzchak is meditative. Yitzchak has one foot on this earth and the other foot beyond the end of the universe. Whereas Rivka has two feet, four limbs, firmly planted on the ground, right? She falls off her camel. She is the grounded member of this couple. He is lasuach basadeh. He's the philosopher. He's the academic. He's the Princeton Institute for Advanced Studies. She's Mrs. Einstein. he's Einstein. Mrs. Einstein is the one who paid the bills. You know, I mean, somebody has to pay the bills in this kind of a marriage. Somebody has to cook the food, do the carpool, you know, run the household, mediate, pay the taxes, make sure, you know, that the water gets turned off so that the sprinkler system doesn't explode in the wintertime. While he is in a lab, in the hospital, in the law firm, at the Supreme Court, in Washington, where I don't have to describe this to you. And we typically think of this as a bad way to be. Oh, they're not together, it's not an equal marriage, they're not, you know, she's the one changing diapers, and he's the one, again, in the lab discovering quarks and neutrinos. It's not bad if it works. Yitzhak and Rivka worked. And Yitzhak and Rivka worked because there was a fundamental respect for each other's roles. Yitzhak never questions Rivka's decisions, even when that decision meant that his beloved Esav doesn't get that bracha. We never hear, think about it. Think about what would happen, what our perception would be of a mother who deceived her husband and perceived her disabled husband, her blind husband, and presented one child as if it were the other child, presented the checkbook and said, sign here, presented the will, changed the will. It's exactly what Rivka did. She changed Yitzhak's will. She took advantage, quote unquote, of an old, blind, befuddled professor whose head was in the clouds and either couldn't or wouldn't see the harsh realities of what his two sons, who by the way were in their 60s at the time, we typically think of Yaakov and Esav as being, you know, the same 15 they were when Esav sold the Bechorah. If you stop and do the math at how old Yaakov was when he got to Haran, I think it's like he was 67. All right. These were not, no more than Yitzchak was like this pathetic little 10-year-old that Abraham was schlepping. He was 37. Yaakov and Esav were in their 60s at the time. They were grown men. And Rivka changed the will. Yitzchak never utters a word of reproach. Not only does he not utter a word of reproach, he supports that decision. He carries it through. Even when Esav comes to him, Vayitzak tzaka gedola umara, you know, rimitani ze pa'amayim, he tricked me twice. And Yitzchak basically said, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. Abraham disagrees with Sarah's decisions. Yaakov blasts Rachel. Very harshly blasts the woman he loves. Tachat Elokim Anochi? Am I God? What are you coming to me for? We'll talk about that in a minute. Yitzchak doesn't protest. Because in the model of marriage of the Yitzchak and the Rivka, it's each partner has his job or her job, and each partner respects and accepts the purview of the other. It is never seen as a competition. It's never seen as a power struggle. It's about as different from the modern American 21st century view of marriage as you can get. It looks fundamentally archaic, but it works. And it sustains what's probably the most devastating blow a marriage can have, which is favoritism and sibling rivalry, and effectively losing two children, because Yaakov runs away and Esav doesn't get the Bechorah. So functionally, Yitzhak and Rivka lost both of their children, both of their sons, which is huge. And I can't even imagine what the rest of their lives were like. Not to mention the fact that according to the calculation of years, Yitzhak saw his own mistakes being played out again in his son's family and saw what happened to Yosef. Again, if you do the math, he's still alive when Yosef is sold. He knows. He knows what happened. And there's not a word of reproach. There's not a word of argument. Rivka handles the ground. Yitzhak handles the sky. And it works. Yitzhak also barely talks. I've never counted the number of words that Yitzhak says, but I would venture that it's less than about 50. Rivka does the talking. And again, it makes sense. Somebody who's in the lab, somebody who's in the book, somebody who's at the computer, they don't talk, they're thinkers. But that's okay. This is that slow to warm up, quiet sort. That's okay. It works. What's important is that it works. Let's move on to Yaakov and his wives. A little note about polygamy. It doesn't work. There's not a single instance of polygamy in the entire Tanakh that ends happily. So that's the first important point that the model of Yaakov and his two wives tells us. It's a cautionary tale. A man may be allowed to marry more than one woman. It's mutter, but it doesn't work. And what's fascinating is in the She'elot and the Tshuvot, and wasn't able to dig the specifics up to bring them to you here, of the Sfaradi world in the 1000s, 1100s, 1200s, 1300s, where amongst Ashkenazim polygamy was already asur, you have basically records of Batei Din ascertaining that the man had both the financial and even more importantly the emotional wherewithal to support more than one household. They basically did background checks before they allowed you to marry more than one woman. Because it really was, you know, you think about Abraham with Hagar, Yaakov with his wives, Elkanah with his wives, David had 18, we saw how well that worked out, one dead baby, three dead sons, Shlomo, well, need we say more, a split melucha, it just doesn't work. So that's the first point. What we have with Yaakov and Rachel is our model of romantic love. The model of what we call the bashert, the lightning strike. Source. Oh, pretty late. I think we're on the back. Cuff. I think we're... here we go. Very bottom of the second page. Source 19. I think? No, that's not right. I think we're missing something. Thank you. Here we go. 20. Except it's... I don't know. Something got a little messed up. It's earlier. But, okay. What if something got messed up here? But in any case, we know the story. Yaakov, at the beginning of Parshat Vayetze, in the beginning of Perek Kaftet, he arrives in Haran. He ascertains that this is where Laban, his uncle, lives, and he's very happy. And then we have this rather bizarre, detailed description of a well in the middle of a field, and three flocks of sheep, and a huge rock on the well, and we're like, who cares? And the who cares comes when Yaakov sees Rachel. Because the who cares is that adrenaline rush that enables you to pick up the Volkswagen that your kid has their foot stuck under. That's adrenaline. That's a physiological response, but it's also an emotional state. What happens between Yaakov and Rachel, or Yaakov towards Rachel, is something very different than what happens between Avram and Sarah and Yitzhak and Rivka, as opposed to Avram and Sarah, who basically start at the same place and walk a parallel path, as opposed to Yitzhak and Rivka, which have this very unequal but very functional relationship, Yaakov falls in love. Yaakov sees Rachel, and he is single-handedly able to do what three or four or five strapping guys cannot do. He can move that rock off the well. What the Torah is telling us is that the power of romantic love is an intense power. It has physical ramifications. It is not something to be messed with. If one person can do the work of four or five in that instant of passion, passion is something that's very powerful. It's not necessarily good, it's not necessarily bad, but it's something that's powerful, and that power has to be dealt with, reckoned with, and the consequences of that power have to be processed. It is only with Yaakov that the verb love is used at the outset of the relationship. It is the only relationship in the entire Tanakh that relationship that begins with love. Okay, we know that Abraham noticed Sarah's beauty. We know that he respected her. We know that Yitzchak and Rivka had a physical relationship. The Torah describes it. The concept of the emotional relationship, of romantic love, of passionate love, is something that's unique to Yaakov and Rachel. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the only other place that love is mentioned in context of a relationship is between David and Yonatan. But check your concordance. The word love, by the way, is a very infrequently used word in the Tanakh in general. And most of the time it's used about God and not about other human beings. So Yaakov falls in love. And we know this because, first of all, we know this because the Torah tells us. And when does the Torah tell us this? The Torah tells us this immediately after what I believe is either source 20 or 21, after it describes Rachel and Leah. Now, typically, we think of Rachel as the pretty one and Leah as the homely one. But that's because we don't look at the text carefully. It says here, and this bit of text is very dear to my heart, given my name, given the fact that I too have weak eyes. It says, right, and Lavan had two daughters, Ula Lavan Shtebanot. The older one, Shem HaGdola. Notice it's Gdola here, not Bechira. Gdola meaning not just older, but possibly greater, was Leah, and Shem HaKtana, Rachel. The Enei Leah Rakot, the Rachel Gifat Toar v'Gifat Maret. Now again, we all typically assume that Rachel was beautiful and Leah was not. Nowhere in the text does it say that. It just says that the Enei Leah Rakot and Rachel's weren't. It says Rachel was beautiful. It doesn't say that Leah wasn't. As a matter of fact, there's a midrash that writes that Rachel and Leah were identical twins, which is why Yaakov couldn't tell them apart. Because if you think about it, even in the dark, if you've known somebody for 7 years, and you've lived in a household with somebody for 7 years, and you have been loving and wanting and even lusting after someone for 7 years, even in pitch blackness, I would find it pretty hard to believe that you would not be able to tell that person from her sister. And to me, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense to say either they were twins, and I possibly identical twins, or that they didn't look so different. And the one feature that was really different about them was Leah's very unique eyes. Whatever Rakot means, either they were soft, you know, puppy brown, or they were weak in the sense that she could be out in the sun, which might explain why Rachel was with the sheep and not Leah was with the sheep, or according to the Midrash, that she was crying because she thought she had to marry Esav, which kind of gives us a sense as to what her spirituality was and what her emotional sensitivity was. In any case, you had these two sisters who functionally were about equal, except for the fact that one was older than the other. And what's the determinant? Vayehav Yaakov et Rachel. That's it. There's no logical explanation. This is law. This is not business. This is not symbiosis. This is not interdependence. This is romance. And it's the only thing that can explain it. And it is a cautionary tale also. And again, in great contradistinction to our 21st century model that romantic love is the be-all and end-all, and you can't marry someone if you don't love them, and what happens when love dies, and what happens when there is no more passion, and all of these things, which are extremely important questions. But what Yaakov and Rachel show us is that love comes with consequences. When you have a marriage, and this is the kind of marriage, my aunt and my uncle had a marriage like this, where basically she is everything to him. We don't know if he is everything to her, but we certainly know that she is everything to him. It affects his ability to do everything else. And it certainly affects the greater system. Nowhere is family systems theory more evident than in Yaakov's family. Because Yaakov's passion for Rachel doesn't just affect Rachel. It affects Leah. Every single one of Leah's sons is named because she wants Yaakov to love her. Because she feels that lack of love. The Dudaim story is because Rachel wants what Leah has. For her, and that's why I'm saying, she was his everything. His love was not enough for Rachel. And Leah says to her, you've taken my man from me, now you want my the Dudaim of my son. You want children? You want the one thing that I can have that you can't? Love is not enough for you? And effectively, Rachel says, no, it's not enough, which is fascinating. Because again, we see in our modern literature, the thing that a woman wants more than anything else is the love of a man. Where for Rachel, the thing that Rachel wants more than anything else is a child. Or, alternatively, what her sister has. Maybe if she had children, she would want the love. And we see the destructive force of that passion. We see the effect that it has on the children. We lose Reuben, we lose Shimon, we almost lose Levi, we almost lose Yehuda, we almost lose Yosef. 5 out of 12, that's a pretty high amount of loss. That's almost 50%. The ones that seem to come out unscathed are Bilhah and Zilpah's children. The children of Leah and Rachel really pay the price for this passion. And again, chas v'shalom, I'm not standing up here to say that passion and love is a bad thing, okay? At Baruch Hashem, I have married almost 24 years to a man that I adore. But what the Torah is saying is that this model of marriage is a model of marriage. But it's not, don't think it's the ideal model. There is no ideal model. The ideal model is a model that works. And it has to work for the couple. The ideal model is Ezer Kenegdo. Is two people facing each other, helping each other, resolving conflict with each other, sometimes opposing each other when they need to be. Ya'azov ish aviva et imo. By the way, Abram and Sarah were the only ones that left the home front. You could probably say that their marriage in a lot of ways was the most successful. They both left their family. They created a new start. Ya'azov ish et aviva et imo, v'davak b'ishto. I go back to that. Dveikut is both something physical. As a Kala teacher, it makes me crazy when I hear about the perception out there that the physical union between a man and a woman is something dirty, is something bad. It's what I call the fundamentalization. Call it Catholic, call it Muslim, I don't care. We lived amongst cultures that look down on women for far too long, and we've lost the Torah perspective on the beauty and the sanctity and the glory of the physical relationship that I teach my students. It's called Kedushin for a reason. Okay, Davak b'ishto, the same verb that's used with Davak, right? Atem adveikim b'Hashem Elokeichem, that same verb that's used to describe the spiritual closeness, that nirvana of Judaism, of clinging to God, is used as the verb between a husband and wife. V'hayu lebasar echad, that they should become as one flesh. Because when a marriage works, regardless of its model, regardless of its method, regardless of the personalities, what happens really is a fusion of Adam 1 and Adam 2. Is a fusion of those two entities who really were at one point basar echad, who were formed together, who were equal together. And by being in an emotional and spiritual dveikut relationship, flourish in their own, maybe flawed, but still their own world and their own universe. Thank you.